if you're on Maple Street.
There's near the barracks?
No, no.
Equipment stored here?
No, no. You know where the CPR station is, eh?
Yeah.
Well, it's just on this end of the CPR station, in between the CPR station and the Manitoba Cold Storage, there's the immigration building. It used to be the immigration building. Well, this was taken out towards Higgins Avenue from the immigration, and we had our stuff stored on the second floor. But at the time, we...
Tropical equipment?
We'll say when we come home, we had, our big, long bags filled with...
Duffel bags filled with our own stuff.
We was billeted in the Robinson Building down by the St. Charles Hotel that used to be by the St. Charles Hotel, eh? We didn't have room to store it, our stuff there, so we had it stored in here. We had to have a guard on it in case somebody broke in and...
Now, this is just a bunch of you guys get it every
time? This here is all B Company.
B Company?
This is all B Company. Each day, a company had to put on a guard. And this is a B Company, all B Company guy.
Okay, so...
Now, to tell you their names, I couldn't... I know this guy is Rod Zane.
That's the top left-hand corner.
Yeah, that's Rod Zane. This is Larson.
Bottom left.
A lot of the guys could pick them out. This is myself. This, I believe, is Tony Jelly.
Sergeant.
Yeah. This is Lance Corporal Hollingsworth.
Far right bottom.
I think, I don't know who that is. I think this is Dolly B.
Second from the right on the top.
No, this is Dolly here.
Dolly, so that's fourth from the right.
We used to call him Dolly because he was just a... In fact, he was pretty or too young to be with us.
He was a big smiler, wasn't he?
Yeah, oh yeah. Real good joker. This is... he was from Portland.
Dixon.
That's a long time ago. A lot of people.
That would be taken September, first part of October.
Yeah. After coming home from Jamaica.
Okay, that's great. One, two. Anyway.
First thing we'd know would be your full name.
My full name?
Yeah, I just have your initial, your last name and your initial.
Well, as far as the Army is concerned, my first name is Chester Butt.
Chester Butt.
Yeah.
And can I ask how old you were when you did the Grenadiers?
25.
Did you work in high school?
I had went to school and I was working on a farm in Newport.
Was this a father's farm?
No. No, my father died in 1928 when I was 14 years old.
So were you born in the city?
No, I was at Kelwood, Manitoba.
I have relatives up here.
No?
Yeah. And then you were working on the farm near Nipaw.
Yeah.
And the war had broken out by that time?
The war... the war broke out on the 9th of September. I joined the Army on the 26th. But we had already been in, me and another chum, trying to get in their artillery. Then we went from there to Grenadiers, so they sent me home for 2 weeks, and I got back in on the 26th. I grew that a half an inch, they wanted.
Yeah. So the war had started in Europe, and you were...
We were sitting at the table having dinner one day, and they had bombed this, the Germans had bombed this school with these children in the school, and right then, that was it. Army for me, boy. Me and my chum wanted to get in the artillery. And then after that, but they told us all they wanted was a couple of mechanics and, a couple of green farm boys. We told them we didn't know anything. If we'd have known what we know now, we'd have told them we was the best mechanics in the world and been in the artillery. But
you went into the grenadiers.
Yeah.
Did you have any trouble getting in, aside from the fact that you were 2 inches
half an inch too short? No, no, no.
And you took your training in wood.
Yeah. We was in Minto Army until 23rd December, then we went to Fort Augustine.
Was there any training?
Oh yes, we had the full regiment.
And
fast
did you train, what you were training at?
Well, we was the Vickers machine gun regiment.
I don't want to keep asking questions at this point. Maybe you can tell me some more about the training, what it involved.
Well, then they put me on, I was a range taker. I used to lay out behind Fort Osmond Barracks and watch the cars coming down Ellis Avenue, you know, and take ranges on the hubcaps. Then I started flag signaling, semaphoring. And the company commander came in one day and he stopped me from doing this. He said, "You're a rangefinder." He says, "That's enough for you. One job in this army is enough for any man." So he cut that out. Then we went out to St. Charles and we was firing Vickers machine guns, rifles. I ended up as the number one Vickers machine gun.
Did you enjoy work?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. First 2 or 3 weeks I thought it was going to kill me, you know, but after working on the farm, it was hard work on the farm, but the different type of stuff, you know, but after that, I enjoyed the army life.
Did you get on
again? Oh, 100%. Maybe some of them will tell you different, but...
I'd like to know, after your training, you went to Jamaica.
Jamaica, yeah.
I know quite a bit about Jamaica. I thought maybe when you came back to Winnipeg, you were in Winnipeg for about 6 weeks.
About 6 weeks, yeah.
And you went to?
To Hong Kong.
Some people told me about the fact that some of the men were sick when they came back and their recruits had gone down to replace them.
Yeah, this is right. We picked up... when we was in Jamaica about 3 months before we come home from Jamaica, we picked up, there was about over 150, I guess, come down to replace them. And then when we come home, we picked up about another 300 to go to Hong Kong with. Guys that had to have malaria bad, or this dengue fever, which is a slight... Something like malaria, only we'll say slighter.
Is there any kind of cure? Any kind of treatment?
Oh yes, they give you quinine. Over in Hong Kong, I was had dysentery. They let me out of dysentery one morning, and this Dr. Gray from Edmonton, he was our doctor, so he told me to go and get my temperature taken every 2 hours. He figured that I wasn't just right, I said I was. And I was out on a count at 5 o'clock, and when I came in off the count, I had a temperature of 105.
Well, there were quite a few men that joined you in Jamaica.
Yes, about 100, I think about 150 come down to Jamaica, and then when we come home, we had to pick up about another 300, because we had to leave some more at home that had been with us. Yeah, sick, or one thing or another wrong with them. But,
I was told that, were you still working machine guns at this time? I was told that.
That's right, we was a machine gun regiment. When we got over to Hong Kong, this General Mulpin, this English general, he gets the wise idea that this Quebec regiment, which was a rifle regiment, should have the machine guns, and we should have the rifles.
And you had the had you been trained as a machine gun?
All this time, we was all, well, as far as I'm concerned, I was number one machine gunner, but any man in the regiment outside of the ones that we had just freshly picked up was all number one machine gunners, as far as I was concerned.
Did you do any machine gun training in the regiment?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, the troops that joined the regiment, do you know if they had done any machine gun?
I doubt it. Because it was at the holding unit, number 10, here at Fort Austin Barracks. They were guys from different regiments, and they just took so many from.
Well, when you came back from training, did you have any training in machine gun? Did you know that you were coming back for a long period of time, or a short period of time?
No, we didn't know. We was told we was going to Vancouver to join the 6th Division, and there was no such a thing as the 6th Division. They took us off the train at Jasper and told us where we was going to.
Well, they did.
Yeah.
They said they
want to
come.
Yeah.
Well, then you arrived in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Can you tell me something about the events? What happened?
Well, we just arrived in Vancouver and got on the boat and took off. We sat in Manila, you know, at Pearl Harbor. We sat in Pearl Harbor for 4 days refueling. And then we left Manila and went to Hong Kong. We landed in Hong Kong on the 15th of November.
Do you remember any of the trip going over? Was it rough trip?
It wasn't rough for me because... what's his name? Transport officer. He was orderly officer. So he come to Ernie Hodgkinson, like my company commander. He wanted me for orderly sergeant all the way over on the boat, so all we do is pull around and take a look at the anti-act guys, you know. And
would these be Australians?
Eh?
These are Australians, yeah.
Australia?
Yeah.
No. We had set up our own Bren guns. But it was an Australian boat that we went on. They had converted this Awatea into a troop ship.
It was manned by Australians? It was Australian sailors?
Yeah. They had Australian crew on it.
Do you remember how long it took to get
over to? Well, 17 days. No, wait a minute. To be exact, I couldn't tell. I don't exactly know the day we left Vancouver. I know we sat in Pearl Harbor for 4 days refueling. We couldn't get off the boat because the United States wasn't in the war. They had these sailors, American sailors, you know, down on the docks, so we couldn't get off the boat. I think if somebody would turn their back, they'd let us all off the boat, but it was just a case that we couldn't get off, or it would have been a war violation, you see.
I guess people weren't too happy about that,
having
to get
into land. Oh, we had lots of entertainment. They had this Hawaiian outfits. Girls with their grass skirts down on the dock all day long, and dancing and playing for us all day long. So we had lots of entertainment.
Do you remember, was there any entertainment on the boat at all? Were you doing any training?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Machine gun training?
Yeah, we had a training period. We'd start out with PT in the morning and something going on all day long.
But then you arrived in Hong Kong, you remember much about the day you arrived, what you expected to find there when you got there?
Well, I know when we arrived, when we got off the boat and was marching out to Jamshapo camp, the Chinese, they was booing us and turning their back on us and all this. But who knows, maybe half of them was Japanese. I don't know. It's pretty hard to tell the difference then.
Was it about what you expected, do you remember?
And well, I'll tell you, it's a pretty dirty place, Hong Kong. Dirtiest place in the world, I think.
Well,
got
to the camp.
Well, yeah, and then this—we no sooner got our equipment off, and the bugle blows for the NCOs and the officers to fall out, and this molting character, he starts giving us a speech, you know, that if any imperial soldier of the equivalent rank, will say a sergeant, told me to do something, I would do it because he was superior, right? And this RSM that we had, Patty Keenan, you can maybe talk to him. He takes a step out of the rank. He was an old Imperial soldier from the First War, and he told Maltby, he says, I know if any of your sergeants tells any of my sergeants what to do, where they will be told to go to. And I think we got off on the wrong foot to start with. And so they bring in three Royal Scots. You see on the map there where the Royal Scots were?
Yeah.
They bring in three Royal Scots sergeants to give us NCOs a instructor's course. And this was all we was doing down in Jamaica for 16 months was instructing, plus doing our little bit on taking our turn on this guard stuff, this internment camp. And they got in there, and they was in the sergeant's mess, and they was, you know, kicking up quite a stink, a few drinks in them, you know, and they talked loud, and in our mess, you couldn't talk loud. You, it didn't matter. You kept your voice down. They had run better than any club that's running Winnipeg right now. And old Patty Keenan, he came in, and he told them to keep quiet, and we shoved them in the guardhouse at last, which you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to put them in their quarters and have another sergeant sitting with them. And when he done that, he phoned up the colonel and told the colonel the Royal Scots to come up and get them out, take them up in the motorcycle escort, everything, took them out. And the next morning, when we get up, these Middlesex guys, the funny thing, the Royal Scots was all Englishmen, and the Middlesex was all Scotchmen. And so they picked out one guy to give certain group, you know, instructions, eh? And there was
what kind of instructions?
On machine guns, the Lewis guns, Vickers guns, and all this. And we had done this down Jamaica. And down Jamaica, we got to a point where we'd done it so often, we used to blindfold the guys, you know, and blindfold ourselves so we could do it in the dark, you know, to strip it down and put the gun together. So this sergeant that we got, this Middlesex guy, there was Manchester, Marsh, and Sergeant Woods, and myself. So we draw this the Vickers, not Vickers, Lewis machine gun. And so this guy, the sergeant, the Middlesex sergeant, he tells Woods to strip it, eh? So Manchester, he pipes up and he says, I'll make you bet that Woods can strip it faster blindfold than you can without. And this guy wouldn't believe him. So he took him on. Woods beat him, so after that, when we draw a piece of sweat, and we just go around behind the hut and sit there and shade all day.
Well, how about the other men? The recruits that have been picked up here in Winnipeg, and some of them have been sent to Jamaica, others have just joined here, I gather.
Yeah. We had one kid in our outfit that young English, he'd just been in the army 8 days. He still should have been going to school. He didn't know what end of the rifle was, the butt was on, you might say.
Well, anyway, you had become infantry by this time, Colonel Lobby?
Well, yeah, he had the Royal Rifles was going to have the machine guns, the youth characters was going to, maybe because we kicked the Royal Scots out, I don't know, you guys was going to have the rifles.
Is that the way it worked out?
And that's the way it worked out.
Well, were you expecting more at this time with the Japanese?
No.
I understand the Grenadiers were sent to Hong Kong as a garrison force.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I personally, myself, I think it was a political setup. Now, I might be wrong.
Yeah. But I was just wondering what you felt at that time. Did you know that the Japanese were going to be at war?
Well, they at then, they was negotiating with the states, eh? Mm-hmm.
And by sending us 2,000 Canadians or 2,200 Canadians over there, ain't going to scare the Japanese or anybody else, as far as I'm concerned.
Did you feel that way then?
Yeah, sure.
Well, were people expecting war to break up? The Japanese weren't very far away.
No. Just what I was going to say, like the British had 27 miles leased of the, they called it the New Territories, of the mainland, like there's Hong Kong sitting out here, and Kowloon over, you know, across the channel. Well, this belonged to the British because they had 27 miles leased. And we was out firing anti-tank rifles. About 26 miles, 26 and a half miles out. And he was facing back towards Hong Kong, back towards the island. And while we were firing these anti-tank rifles, all you had to do is look behind you and see the Japs sitting in the outposts watching you. And this was on Saturday, and war broke out Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
That close. anti-tank rifles. Now,
yeah.
Would this be British equipment or Grenadier equipment? I'm kind of anxious to know about the equipment.
I think this was probably British equipment because I don't remember of us. We'd never fired an anti-tank rifle. This was a 5.5 bullet that was all, you know, about so around 6 inches long. The magazine held 5 shots, you know. And when you pulled the trigger on that and one of them went back, well, it swung you right around and the gun lifted right off the ground, and when it hit the ground, well, you was all ready to pull her again and let him throw you back again.
I was thinking that's a pretty curious place to be shooting up near where the Japanese could be watching. I wonder if that was the whole idea of the exercise.
Well, it could be. Could be that they had us all out there with these anti-tank rifles, all day bringing your tanks so we were ready for you, but...
Do you remember when war broke out?
War broke out on the 9th of December.
Do you remember how? What you were doing?
We was over on Sunday. This was on Saturday. And on Sunday, we went over to Aberdeen. Like, we went to Rusty Young and I, and our platoon went to Aberdeen. Some of the other guys went to Wong Chai Gap. We went to the positions on the island we were supposed to hold, eh? The next morning at 9 o'clock, we see these planes flying over. And at first we figured it was our planes. And then we look up and it's the Japs, and they start dropping bombs, and that was it. And we knew them that it was for real.
Yeah. Well, did you know
it?
Did you have enough equipment at that time? Did you feel you had enough? Were you really prepared?
No, we knew we didn't have equipment. There was a boat coming behind us that was supposed to be bringing our equipment. But they didn't get there. They ended up in Australia. Yeah.
Well, did you have enough equipment with you the day the war started or previous to that? Were you building up with equipment, making preparations for the war? No.
All the equipment we had was what we took with us ourselves on the boat. And on the Awatea, there was all of us and all of the Royal Scots but one company. And the other company was on the Prince Rupert that escorted us over there.
Well, the day war broke out, you had a rifle with you.
You know, myself, I had a Tommy gun. I used the Tommy gun. The sergeants all had Tommy guns, but the rest of the guys had rifles, and Bren gun.
And you were in Hong Kong Island?
Yeah, we was on the island. The day the war broke out, we had moved over onto the island. We come back in from firing the anti-tank rifles and moved over to the island. And just at 9 o'clock the next morning is when they hit.
And then you stayed on the island throughout?
We stayed on the island until we was taken prisoner.
I wonder if you can remember what you maybe did in the first few days. Did the Japanese, where were you on the island?
Well, we was over in Aberdeen and they landed from Kowloon. They landed across the channel from the mainland. Well, here's Victoria here, so the mainland would be over here, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So they come across here. They come across here. We was over at Aberdeen. Yeah, that's right. They come across here. And the wireless setup was out.
They came across a boat by the Torrey?
Yeah, because the channel. Here's where they come across, right?
Here's a little larger map of where
that was. Here's where they come across right here. This is Kowloon. That strip across there, Champchapeau.
Mm-hmm.
This is the barracks, see?
Right.
This is the barracks. Well, up here, 27 miles from Kowloon, was where the British had at least, see?
This is the same thing, only it's bigger. Here's the Chinese border here. Here's Hong Kong. This is just me, the island blown up.
Here we are, right here, likely. That's likely what the British had leased, is it?
This area down here. Here's the border. This is a place called Gin Drinker's Line on the 9th of December.
Yeah. Well, that's where the Japs were all lined up, eh? That's
right.
27 miles in from Kowloon.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is where they were all lined up.
Right.
About 80,000 of the bugger. Mm-hmm. All lined up there, and we was just out here,
about a short way.
Just out here, firing this way with the anti-tank rifle.
Not far at all. Well, okay, then you moved down to Aberdeen.
Yeah, we went over down. We moved to Aberdeen.
Can you remember how many men moved? Was your company?
This was our company. We moved to Aberdeen. We had roadblocks.
It was D Company?
B Company.
B Company.
Yeah, we moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And headquarters had moved in behind Wong Chai Gap. Our headquarters was just in. You come through the gap here, eh?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the channel was out here.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, or out here rather. This is Victoria Harbor.
Right.
The channel was out here. And the headquarters was in here. Well, when we come back from Mount Cameron, we had to come through here to get back into Wong Chai Gap where the first aid station was.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when we started to come back through, they started to kill us. Then coming down Black Links Road don't show.
No, Black the roads really aren't marked on.
Yeah, well, Black Links Road would be, where's that police station?
The police station is right here.
Yeah, okay then, this will be Black Links Road coming over here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we come over here, when we was coming across here, the Japs had these 6-inch howitzers sitting out here.
This would be out towards the harbor.
Yeah.
About Layton Hill or something.
Yeah, they had them sitting there, and as they was coming out, I was hit. There was a guy bringing me out. Well, I think there was nine of us, that guys didn't get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And as they was bringing us out, they was slapping at us with these 6-inch howitzers all the way up.
Do you remember about what day of the war this would be?
That was on the 19th.
That was on the
19th. That was on the 19th. That was the morning I got hit. I got hit at 11 o'clock, and it was 5 o'clock by the time I got to Victoria.
To the hospital.
Yeah.
So it must have been a long day for you. Well, do you remember what you did between the time the war started and the 19th? Do you remember much of what you did?
Yeah, here.
You were at Aberdeen.
It was at Aberdeen when the war started, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, at there was a cemetery. There was a cemetery just up from Aberdeen.
Right.
And we had these, there was a, what they call it, water in catchment. That's the only water you got on the island was when it rained. You got this fresh water that run into reservoirs. And well, the first thing the Japs did, they come over and they bombed these reservoirs and let all the water out.
Mm-hmm.
No water. But in the daytime, one of these water in catchments run up the mountain here, eh?
Right. And from Aberdeen up to
from Aberdeen up. Well, we
almost north.
Yeah. Well, we took our platoon and we had guys scattered out all the way along the water and catchment, dug in along the side. And then at night we'd come down into the town because there was a road coming along here and there was a road coming this way.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sat up right here. The Joss was here. The Chinese used to go in there and light trees and the hand signs and one thing or another. We had a machine gun sitting outside just in case we could get the Japs if they come either three ways, eh?
Right.
Because we knew they'd landed on the island, but we didn't know which way they would come, you know.
Okay. Do you remember how you knew they'd landed? Were you, did you have radio contact?
Well, the ration truck used to come around, you know, and we'd heard they'd landed. And all across here, they had these pill boxes, eh?
This would be along the harbor area.
The British had these pill boxes.
Yeah.
But the bugger that dealt them, you know, there was supposed to be cement, and there was rolls of paper in the bloody things. And in the top, it was built into the side of the mountain, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top, there was a vent. Well, all the Japs had to do was get above you and drop a hand grenade down in there, and
that would be it.
And so everybody got out of them. There's absolutely no use. Get out and sit out in the hills.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And over here at Fort Stanley.
Well,
over here at Fort Stanley, the Japs, as I say, they were sitting up here, 80,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all the British. As far as I'm concerned, British might have been all right way back when they had sailboats and nobody else had anything. But over here they had all their artillery.
At
Fort Stanley,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Facing out to sea.
Well, was there any artillery or pillboxes or anything around Aberdeen?
No.
Were you supposed to be watching the sea? Were you
there was a little island. There was a little island across here, you see.
Yeah.
But the Japs could have come in. We got a plane one night, us guys sitting in this roadblock.
Mm-hmm.
We were sitting in this roadblock and this plane came in. There was just a little bit of water here.
Mm-hmm.
And then this island, eh?
Yeah.
This little island here. And over right on the edge of this little island there was a pig ranch.
Right.
And they come over and there was a little boat sitting in here. And this plane went to drop a bomb on this boat. Center dropped the bomb on the boat, this little gunboat. He hit the pig ranch, you know, and he made another sweep at it, so we cut loose with the Bren guns, and we got him. He just went over the hill.
That would be your first victory?
That was just our good luck, because we should, no way in the world should we have got him with a Bren gun, but we was just back there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as from here, that light pole down.
Oh, that would be too far.
No.
A couple of 300 yards?
Yeah, about 300 yards. So I'd say that was our first.
Had you engaged any of the enemy at that time?
No.
Did you see any Japanese?
No, we never run into any Japanese until we started around here to Montcalm.
Right. Now that would be later. That's about 18th or 19th.
That would be the afternoon of the 18th that we run into them. And we come back around the corner of Mount Cameron and dug in overnight, and then in the morning. Sergeant Woods and I, we walked about 2 miles right through here. Through that Black Lakes Road up here. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
We walked about 2 miles through and they were sitting on both sides of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And we come back. And we just got back just about ready to go around the corner and Woods, he threw a hand grenade. They started to shoot. They got him and shot him in the head. Him and I were both. So I started, like a deer, 2 feet this side of the road, and the next step, 2 feet this side of the road, and I got around the corner, and we figured there was about 300. So then we started the camp, and the mountain just come down to a little, just like a little hill coming down here. So the sergeant major, we decided we'd put trench mortar just around the corner. We done that for
trench mortar.
A trench.
No.
Just a round pipe.
Yeah.
More or less. A round pipe and you drop this mortar thing down in it, and when it hits it goes up and it lobs it in to wherever you want it. You tilt the head or back, or this way or that way to get it to where you hit. And then when it hits the ground it explodes. We done that for about an hour and a half, and then we figured we had them stirred up pretty good. Well, then around the corner we come. About 11 o'clock in the morning, I got hit.
I was just wondering in the days that you were at Aberdeen.
Well, in the days at Aberdeen, as
you,
I said,
you were on a roadblock.
We was on a roadblock here at 90, and then in the daytime we would move up along this water in Ketchum, you know, and set up. And I had this long trench, and I had this rangefinder, and the road was down. We'll say like where Henderson Highway is here, and I had taken ranges on 3 or 4 different points. We had a machine gun sitting out in front of us. And if the Japs would have come along in the daytime, I knew exactly
where
to set, what range to set the machine gun at, and so we could watch that in the daytime. But at night we moved right down in there.
Yeah, so you were pretty ready for them.
Oh, we was ready for them.
Yeah.
We wasn't...
How about food and water? Did you have enough food and water to last you in the day? The ration.
I would say yes after what we got after.
Afterwards. How about at that time?
No, I think we done our... I think the ration truck would capture us pretty good.
Yeah, it came along.
It's come along pretty regular. After all, you can't, in a spot like that, you can't have your meals right on 12 o'clock. No, I got no complaints along them lines at all. I don't, myself. Maybe in some, we'll say where B Company got boxed in here, they probably got down to...
I was just wondering if there was any periods where you went for days without eating or drinking water.
No, because when we got into Mount Cameron, we wasn't in there long enough that we run into so many of them that there was 35 of us. We run into so many of them, we outnumbered about 10 to 1 that... And when the guys started to get hit, as I say, when we come out, there was only about nine out of the whole bunch that hadn't got hit.
Did you know what to expect from the Japanese if you had surrendered?
Well, we had a pretty fair idea. In fact, our sergeant major told us to keep the last bullet for ourselves. But me, I didn't have that much guts. I'd use the last one on the other guy.
And the orders that you... I don't know, I was just wondering if you could tell about the progress of the Japanese. Did you know what was happening on the other parts of the island? To, say, the Indian troops or to the British?
No, not necessarily. We didn't know. All this, as I say, about the Royal Scots filing them up at Fort Stanley, this is... what we heard after, when we was taken prisoners and got back, we got put in camps and one thing another, different guys would get talking. In fact, they put the Canadians in North Point Camp, which was on the island. And they was going around trying to find out who was fighting on Mount Cameron. Well, all us guys, even Rusty Young, we were all wearing... coveralls. Like as far as anybody knowing me, I was a grenadier, I was a sergeant, or Rusty was a lieutenant, and he was a grenadier, nobody knew the difference. We were all wearing coveralls.
This was during the battle?
This was during the battle.
Yeah. The coveralls.
Yeah. We put coveralls on and just like a bunch of farmers.
Yeah. Had you had any guerrilla warfare training?
No. The first warfare we ever got was when we run into these guys the day before.
you said that you really didn't know much of what was happening on other parts of the island during what was going on.
No.
And you were wounded.
Yeah, on the 19th. I got hit on the 19th. Well, this Black Lynx Road was cut on the side of the mountain, we're saying, down over the, we just cut it on the side of the mountain and the dirt down over the siding.
Yeah.
And we was in so close it was like fighting in this backyard.
Yeah.
and he was throwing hand grenades. The gravel was flying up around you, and I got a hand grenade in the side here, and it blew across the muscle of my stomach. And
the shrapnel from it?
The shrapnel. Yeah, it went in just above my hip bone, below my ribs, and it dug in and took all the muscle off this side. And at the same time, I got another piece of it. If you've seen the buckle on the web equipment, it flips like this. Well, it cut the one that hit me in the front, cut the clip off, and it blew all my equipment about 20 feet up the side of the mountain. And this guy that took me out, well, it took us about 4 hours. We went the night before, but I think it only took us about 20 minutes to go out after we got in. I got hit. I was holding my insides out like this because it blew out the front too. The shrapnel and come out. I was holding my insides like this, and I figured about 4 miles I run. I was just like a boar. And this Nels Gelbreth, he was holding me up, and every time these 6-inch howitzers, we'd hear one of them coming, he'd just let me go, and I'd go flat on my face, and when it would hit, he'd grab me by the shoulders and up, and when I got half straightened up, my old legs just went.
Did you know where the howitzers were coming?
Yeah, we knew it. We could see them, but we couldn't do anything about them. Because they was across the ravine, way over on the other side of the mountain. These 6-inch howitzers, they're like big artillery. Well, not, they're like small artillery.
You would be wondering if this was it or not.
You forget about that. Once the first bullet goes by your ear, well, like eating your breakfast.
Well, where did you go from there? Were you able to move on your own at all?
I could run, and you know, because it's just like it would say breaking your arm. Yeah, more or less wasn't known. And then when they got me in the ambulance, and we had to get out to Wangshai Gap because they were shelling it from the harbor. And when we started out, then we had
boats.
This was Japanese boats, hey? Yeah. Then we had to go right down practically to the harbor to Victoria. Mm-hmm. Just up on the top of the hill from Victoria was where Bowen Road Hospital was, where they was heading for us. Oh. The boats were sitting out here, eh?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they were shelling us coming out of Wangshai Gap here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we had to come down in around here to get over to just above Victoria, to Bowen Road Hospital.
Right.
And every time they get a look at the bloody ambulance, they start lobbing.
What kind of ambulance? Do you remember?
Like
a Jeep or something?
No, it was Red Cross. An Army ambulance.
Yeah, like an Army truck with red crosses?
Yeah.
And they were shelling
it? Oh, yeah, they'd shell it everywhere. That's what took us so long, because every time they started shelling us, we'd pull in somewhere to get out of the road. They didn't pay any attention to any of that kind of stuff out for us.
They could move the shell.
Yeah. Knock everything out they can.
Well, you were going to Bowen Road?
Bowen Road Hospital.
Bowen Road.
Yeah. I didn't get take. I was there till 5th of May or the 20th of May before they took me into the prison camp.
When you got to the hospital, were there many other Americans, Canadians?
Well, there's no Americans.
Canadian, British, or Indian troops?
Canadians, there was a Dutch, a little Dutch boat that got caught in there. So when they got caught in there, they grabbed rifles too. There were some of them in there. And Hong Kong infantry volunteers, which was mostly Portuguese, you know, that was living in Hong Kong. They had a volunteer outfit. But then when the war broke over, the Japs came in, all the medication and one thing or another, they smashed it all.
Can you remember much of the surrender, or do you remember the surrender at all? You had been hit.
Yeah, I was in the hospital.
You've been hit once?
Yeah.
I got hit on the 19th. I was in hospital and they surrendered on Christmas Day. It was just a case of no ammunition, no, so they had to, as we say, pack it up.
Then you stayed in the hospital for a length of time?
Yeah, till May.
And then you went to the prison camp?
And then I went to prison camp. And then I was in the prison camp not too long until the diphtheria broke out.
Was this Shamshu-Pogo?
No, this was North Point.
North Point.
North Point. They kept all the Canadians in North Point. And then just after I went to North Point, they moved us all to Shamshu-Pogo over on the mainland. And I was in there a little while, and then the diphtheria broke out. And they had myself and a few more. I didn't have diphtheria, but I was a dip carrier. I was one of the carriers there, and they had us isolated over in one corner of the camp. And they let me out that night in camp. I took convulsions. And they took me across the channel back to Bowen Road. And they kept me knocked out with morphine for 10 days. And when I come to one night, I guess before I should have done, I got out of bed and I was trying to bash my head against the bedpost, so they tied me down. But I had what they call pellagra in my, and there was matter running out my ears and my nose and my eyes, and more or less the inside of my head had, we'll say, gone rotten.
Now, when did it hit you?
No, they was Canadian and British, our own doctors. They had taken all the nurses out and taken them over to Fort Stanley.
Fort Stanley?
Yeah, and put them.
Fort Stanley.
Yeah, and put them in a sort of an internment to, yeah. They put them in with the civilians.
That's for the civilians, weren't you?
Yeah. So I weighed 187 pounds when we landed there, and in 41, on the 15th of November, and on the 23rd of December of 42, I weighed 93 pounds.
You stayed in the hospital for a while, until May, and then you got out, and then you went back to the hospital.
Yeah.
Do you remember when that would be?
Yeah, 26 November, on my birthday.
That would be 41?
No, 40...
Just 42. You'd been in the hospital for quite a while. Can I ask what you were eating at the time? Was it food in there? Was there enough medication?
No, they had no serum for dip. We was fortunate in a way. The Japs brought in a bunch of Formosan troops. See, the Japs had taken Formosa. And they brought in a bunch of Formosan troops to for sentries. And they had Jap... what they called the number one soldier, number two soldier, number one was like a lance corporal on our today. And they had them over, and these little Formosan guys, they used to sneak in duck eggs and sugar. Christmas time, if you got to know one pretty good, you'd sneak in a bottle of sake. Otherwise, if it hadn't been for them little guys, I think we'd have been... This is why right now I stick up for Formosa, not China. As far as I'm concerned, China, a Chinaman. I got more respect for a Jap than I have for a Chinaman. Chinaman is the biggest bowl of rice. Maybe it's changed since the communists took over, but then
Whoever has the biggest bowl of rice, that's good enough for him.
Is that the way you found it?
That's the way I found it.
I've heard some talk about fifth columns, so I'm just wondering if you have any experience with anything like that.
What do you mean by
Well, Chinese working for the Japanese.
Oh, well, this is what I say. Whoever, until we was taken prisoners, we was fine. But as soon as we was taken prisoners, in fact, we at Mount Cameron, we let some Chinese through to go up on the hill. It was just a little scrub, you know, to cut it for wood. Mm-hmm. And when they come down that night, we look up and they've got these arrows pointing down to all our positions, you know. So the next day, no Chinese, I'm telling you. This is what I say, I got more respect for Jap. And Jap, he was like, we'll say you or I, he was fighting, he figured he was fighting because he was right, where Chinaman, if you can give me a bigger bowl of rice than the next guy, well, you're good enough for me.
After you were hit and you got to the hospital, did you remain conscious, able to move around at all?
Oh, they had me in bed for quite a while.
Yeah, but I just wondered if you remembered things that happened.
Oh yes. I can remember when they put me on the operating table. That's why I say it was 5 o'clock at night. When they put, I can remember when they took me in there. There was this girl, VAD, voluntary. This is what the British had. They were like our nurses' aides here. She had this big pair of scissors. She's cutting my clothes off. She looked like a girl I used to go with around Nipah, you know. And when she starts cutting my clothes off, I looked at her and said, "You're a long way from home, ain't you?" She's no ain't you. And then she was one of the British army officers, like, you know. And after I got better, he was in there wounded. She took me in to give me an introduction to her. But this one night, a couple nights after I'd had my operation, I wake up at night, and I still take nightmares. You can ask her. I still take nightmares, you know. And I wake up in the Jap, so they're just pouring all over us. And I got two. I guess I must have been talking to Maltbeam, but I got my two machine guns back, and I got a crew sitting here and a crew sitting here, you know. And I'm up in the bed, and they're really pouring it to the Japs. And this nurse come down, and she's wheel settled M slant eyes down, and she gave me a hypo and knocked me out cold. I guess I was keeping everybody else awake, I don't know.
Do you remember much of what happened in the 6 months in the hospital? The conditions get worse?
No, I don't know whether they got worse or not. I think we all more or less pooled what we had and got along the best way we could. I don't think they really, in the prison camp things, maybe we got a little bit more in the hospital than we did in the prison camp. In fact, I think we did, because I know when I got in the prison camp, we were eating boiled rice and boiled fish heads and potato tops.
Did you know what was happening in the prison camp?
No.
I was wondering if you were getting any information. Was you on the island or in the prison camp?
And the prison camps was over on the mainland.
Yes, sir. I guess at first, though, it was on the island, too.
Yeah. And any guy that was brought over to the hospital was generally too sick to tell you anything about it anyway, or wasn't in the right frame of mind to say anything, you know.
You stayed in the hospital or the prison camp after the hospital. Did you spend the rest of the war in the hospital?
No. I went back to, I was in there, I don't know. It was a long time. And then I went back to Sham Shapul, to the other prison camp. But When I went back the second time, then they, these little promotion guys, they had started to smuggle serum into us for diphtheria, and they, you know, this we had a doctor there. His he was the doctor of the Punjabs. He was his dad was British and his mother was Indian, but he was. He had these. He could speak a little bit of Japanese, and the Japanese, they'd come in and they'd want to do something for them. So he, for them, so he'd say, "Well, you bring me in so much cerium of this, or so much of this, and so much of that, then I'll do what you want. But you bring it in first."
He's a good doctor.
Yeah, he was a good doctor. He used to. Us guys used to, like Dr. Crawford, you know, who's the head, I don't know whether he is now or not, but he was the head doctor of all the armed services down in Ottawa when, just after we come home. He used to tell us guys to eat all the, used to be able to get garlic. In fact, when we first got our, first got Red Cross prizes, you know, we got tomato soup, mm-hmm. and all the well, we didn't have bathrooms. We had sort of a pole along the ocean wall, you know, and you do your business in this, in these here barrel thing, in these tubs, and they used it for fertilizer.
Would these tubs be outside the hospital?
No, inside the prison camp, but you know, along the seawall, yeah. All right. And the tomato seed started to grow, so we started to grow tomatoes. You know, there was lots of acid in them, but that's how we got started in tomatoes.
did you grow many other vegetables too?
Oh, sweet potatoes. And, that's about it. But you just cut the tops off. You didn't want to dig the tomato out and eat it because then you had nothing to grow tops with.
Yeah. Dr. Crawford, I've heard his name mentioned before. Did he stay in the prison camp for most of the time?
Yeah.
Was he in both of them? Because I've heard a lot of men.
No, he was in the prison camp a lot. He was our doctor. Right? He was our doctor, and Dr. Gray from Edmonton. He was a young fellow. He was a good doctor. But Dr. Crawford was a baby doctor, for God's sakes, before the war broke out. He was a baby specialist. So maybe he was with the right regiment. I don't know.
Are there any incidents or things happened that when you were in camp or in the hospital that you would sort of stand out of the in your mind?
Oh, I don't know.
Like catching snakes and frying them?
Oh, well, that was normal story. You get hungry, you're going to eat, ain't you? I got my teeth knocked out one night. This Kamloops, we called him. The reason why we called him Kamloops, he come from Kamloops, but he got his education here in Winnipeg in St. John's College, where Winnipeg University is now, eh?
Kamloops.
This is what we nicknamed.
Japanese?
He was a Japanese interpreter. Eh? And they had this bloody blackout, and somebody went to the toilet, the banjo we used to use. You know, the Japs called, but somebody went, well, you had to, if the Japs come along, you had to tell them, well, okay, there's three men out of the hut that is there, eh? And all you wore was it was just a piece of board with a strap over it, and what we called a G-string. It was a piece of rag about so wide,
with a string, we'll say from here, you know, string across here. You tied it around your waist and took the rag and pulled it up in underneath, and this is what we had to wear. Eh? This is all we had to wear because our clothes had been all wore out. But when you was out, standing out in front of the hut on this supposedly special guard to tell the Japs if anybody went to the washroom, you know, you had to wear one of these here split hats, you know, that we wore.
Split hat?
I don't know whether there's a picture in that album or not, but not one with the peak, you know. We had these here wedge hats, eh? And this Kamloops come along, and I didn't recognize him. It was in the dark, and I thought it was one of the sentries. And he got up to me, and he hauled off, and he hit me slap in the face. Well, he hit me a slap in the face. Naturally, this hat, it fell off. Well, I should have left it laying there. But I stooped down to pick up this hat, put it back on to salute him, and he gives me both knees and mouth and cleans my teeth out for me. So, but lots of guys got a lot worse than that. How about you? This Crawford, he was pretty near 7 feet. He stood on an apple box one time when the guys was dying of dip. They was blaming the doctor because these guys was dying of dip and they wouldn't give them any serum. And he stood up on a box, like an apple box, and started slapping him around. He couldn't reach him. You laugh about these things now. If he tried it now, Crawford would eat six like him.
He went to school here.
He went to school in St. John's College. He used to tell us, when I was going to school in Winnipeg, you Canadians, you roughed me up. Now it's my turn. And I'll bet you he got treated like just the same as anybody else. I don't think anybody roughed him up in here because he was a Japanese.
Can you remember what the men thought of the guards?
The men?
Yeah. Or you thought of the guards?
Myself, I think any of them will tell you that if it hadn't been for, we'll say, some of the guards and the promotion sentries, there would have been none of us going. Now, I think if you ask any of them, they'll tell you. Some of the guards kicked you around. But these was the Japs, because I know when they was doing the airport, you'd line up in the morning, you know, and they'd be going up around, and they'd be going this number one guy, you know, the guy that was sergeant or whoever was going to be in charge of the work party, he'd be ahead, you know, and there'd be a little promotion guy behind, walking behind him, you know, and he'd be saying, no good, no good, or okay, you know, putting you wise before you got out to behave yourself or else you was going to get it, you know. So, some of them was real tough, but then there was the other ones that helped bring us out of there. No, not too much.
Did you know what was happening? Did the Japanese come and tell you that they were?
The Japanese was winning everything. The Japanese, you know, they tell you all this. In fact, when Roosevelt died, well, that was it. They'd won the war. This was it. And then when McCarthy started pushing them back, this big fat pig, we called him. What was his name? Sato. Double chin on the back of his neck, you know. We used to call him the big fat pig. Well, they took him out and they brought in this Sergeant Major Honda.
As soon as they brought him in, well, then the whole entire system started to change. They started to bring in more food, started to treat us different. In fact, one day I seen him kick a sentry till he was blue because he slapped one of the officers. But they was changing the whole setup. This was just before the war was over. They could see the handwriting on the wall. And
do you remember how much before?
Honda, he must have been in there a good year, I would say. But he was, to me, he was a good guy. He was a soldier. He figured he was right, and he didn't blame us for thinking we was either, you know. Which, in a way, you can't hold anything against a person for. At least I don't.
Well, there wasn't much information coming in then.
No.
But you somehow knew that the Japanese
were... We knew they was getting pushed back for the simple reason we needed to vote on a work party. A lot of these Portuguese women, you know, they had the Portuguese guys, prisoners in the camp with us. And a lot of these... Portuguese women, they never bothered locking them up, you know. You'd be coming back into the work from work parties, and they'd be, you know, standing along the street. In fact, before the war was over, we figured there was something up. The day the war was over, they come over and drop these pamphlets off this aircraft carrier, you know, for us to stay in camp and don't cause any ruckus, because they didn't want us to disrupt the Japs in case they did start wiping us out, you know.
Did you ever see any planes going over?
Oh, yeah. The 1944, the Americans came in, and they started on the 19th of December, and right up till Christmas Eve, they got the Japanese Navy in the harbor, and they torpedo bombed right from the 19th of December, early in the morning till late at night, every day till Christmas Eve. And they came in over our camp, and it took 2 hours. According to us, it took 2 hours for the same flight to come back. Because this one guy, we was at, the camp was in against the edge of the mountain, and then there was the ocean, or the channel. It was a mile and a quarter across the channel. And about every 2 hours, this same guy, this same plane, would come over this same spot in the mountain, and he'd dip his wings as he went over the camp and drop something down with a couple cartons of cigarettes on it, and then he'd start dropping his torpedoes. So we had it all figured out that it took 2 hours, that they was only out, they wasn't out that far, that they could go back and refuel and reload their torpedoes and get back in 2 hours.
Did you know where the planes were coming from?
We knew they was coming off an aircraft carrier.
Did cigarettes and that ever get into the camp that you remember?
Well, cigarette was worth, you know, one guy had a cigarette, he was a millionaire in that place, you know, you might say. And then we got 4 Red Cross parcels, well, 1,363 days, pretty near 4 years. You might as well, as far as I'm concerned, we might as well not. Because it just puts you out of kilter.
This is 4 Red Cross parcels?
Yeah, 17 pounds there was in a Red Cross parcel. You know, chocolate bar.
This is 4 parcels each?
Yeah. This is what we got. And I got 1 parcel from home. And there were socks in it and that. And the Japs, they went through it all. You know, before they give you the parcel, and they cut the heels out of the socks.
The heels out of the
sock. Yeah, they just take a pair of scissors and they chop the heels off and then hand you the sock.
Any reason?
Eh?
Any reason for that?
Any reason.
No reason?
No reason at all. We used to stand up with 3 pair of socks. Anyway, the guys, we had guys in there that could knit, so we just unravel the socks and take the wool and just make feet for them. We get 3 pairs out of one anyway, so.
You remember the planes coming over?
and Portuguese women.
You'd be coming in from work parties, you know, and they'd be signaling, like we'll say 2 weeks before the war was over, eh? before the planes come in, and they come over and they just start to drop these pamphlets, you know.
Yeah.
As we're coming in off the work party, well, 4 days before the planes drop the pamphlets, they quit the work parties. But we'll say 10 days before that, we knew there was something in the wind. Because these Portuguese women, they're all lined up in the streets, you know, and they're motioning to us, you know, and we knew there was that there was something in the wind, but we didn't know what it was. And then this one morning, the work party's all ready to go out, and they just come out and says, no work parties today. The next day, the same thing. On the fourth day, they come over, the American planes come over the camp, and they drop these pamphlets that the war was over to stay put.
What were the Japanese done by this time?
Still around the camp? They were still around the camp, but the night they dropped the pamphlets that night, the Japanese sentries all pulled out. The only guy that stayed in the camp was this Honda I was telling you about, this Sergeant Major.
Did he stick around?
Yeah, he stayed there till our troop, till the Prince Robert was the only Canadian boat, and the rest was American boats. They pulled in, American aircraft carrier and a couple of destroyers. They pulled in and they got off the boat and come up to the camp and took us all back down onto this aircraft carrier. And on the aircraft carrier, they took us into the briefing room. And every place where there was any work parties had went out, they had it all marked, a little pin, you know. Because about 2 months before the war was over, they picked up these two Americans out in the hills. And this little Albert, we used to call him. But the last year we was in there, he used to come over every day. Just looked like a silver streak, you know, up in the sky. And when the typhoons was on, he'd come over at night, you'd think he was coming right over the camp. And these guys was up in the hill, and they was signaling to him, you know. And they knew every place where we worked. In fact, one day we was out working at the airport, and they come along, the Americans come along, and they drop 200-pound bombs on the outside, just small, a few of them, on the outside of the airport fence. And the Japs had these decoys up along the seawall, you know, the edge of the airport, and they dropped straw bombs on them.
Straw bombs?
Yeah.
The information that was
given
back to the Americans was really
bad. Oh yes, oh yes. Well, these two guys out in the hills, they brought them in. They brought them into our camp about 6 weeks or so before the war was over. The Japs caught them, and they brought them in. They was going to take them out, and this
take them out
of our camp, you know. And this colonel that was the Royal Scot colonel that was in charge of the camp, he told them, he says, you leave them two guys in here. If you take them out of the camp, because we had got quite a bit out of them. We had found out all about what they was doing, you know, that's when we really found out they had already taken Manila then, which wasn't too far away from us, that we didn't know anything about. And so the colonel says, you leave them in here, you don't take them out, because if they would have taken them out, they'd have probably shot them. So the Japs, okay, we'll leave them here.
When the war was over, do you remember when the gates were open? Were you allowed to walk out?
We went out that night.
They dropped pamphlets,
and then they come over, and there was a... the camp, and then there was a big parade square, a Jubilee building. They'd come over and they'd just circle around the Jubilee building, and they were dropping food supplies to us. Eh? They dropped everything from Scotch whiskey to name it, Scotch whiskey to toilet paper they dropped. They'd just fly over high enough so that when the parachute would open just so it would just hit the ground, they had there were so many of us detailed, we, the whole bloody camp didn't run out and grab one of these boxes. We, just certain ones of us could go out, and we brought it all off the parade square and put it in stores, and we issued it out, say, an ounce of whiskey tonight, you know, at night, or so much tobacco.
You went from the prison camp down to ship.
Down, yeah, and then you know, we was down there for a while, and then we went back, you know.
Did
for
you down with troops that had arrived? Or
yeah.
Down on your own?
No. They took us down onto the boat and gave us a meal, and then brought us back to camp. And then a few days later, they took us around to Manila, and we was in Manila for, I guess about 2 weeks, because we had to get medicals and get needles for this, needles for that. Then they put us on a boat and brought us to San Francisco. It took us 17 days to get to San Francisco. They could get out in the ocean and make a circle, and they were just killing time to get a little beef on us before we got home, I guess. I don't know.
You were able to eat good food, and you had good medicine to get after? Well, 3 years, 9 months?
We couldn't eat very much at once.
Yeah.
We got our breakfast, and then at 10 o'clock in the morning, over the PA system, they'd announce all POWs down to the galley, and we'd go down and have cake and ice cream or something, and then we'd have our dinner, and then in the afternoon, we'd do the same thing again. At night, we'd have our supper, and then after supper, they'd have a show on, or a play. Some of the guys, you know, in the American Army was actors, one thing or another. There was 5,000 American prisoners of war that was with us, too, coming home. And every night they had something to do on deck. And all the Americans give us a good time.
Those were the good days.
Yeah, them was a good day sometimes.
You came back to San Francisco or San Diego?
We come back from San Francisco, and we got off into a warehouse, and the girls in the American Army, I don't know what they call them, WACs or whatever, the same as they call them, ours.
Mm-hmm.
But they fed us. And then they put us on a train, and they brought us up to Seattle, put us on a boat, and brought us around to the Gordon Head Camp in Victoria. And they kept us there for 3 or 4 days while they, because we had all American. When we landed in Manila, the Americans give us exactly the same equipment as their soldiers had, right down to a knife, fork, and spoon, mess tin, everything. So then when we got back to the Gordon Head Camp, well, we had to get all Canadian uniforms.
And you stayed there for a few days?
And we stayed there for a few days, and then went home to work.
Wow. Can I ask, in the time that you spent since the end of the war until now, has your attitude changed much towards the government? And how do you feel about the whole thing now? Look, a lot of you were very sick when you came back, and you had to spend time in hospital. Did you spend time in hospital?
Yeah, I spent. In fact, I was seeing the doctor yesterday. I got to go and see him tomorrow. I had two hernia operations in the last 2 years where the shrapnel tore the muscle off the inside of my stomach.
Have you been in the hospital for different things?
Oh, yeah. I was in, when I first came home, I was in for 13 months. I had an operation every month for 13 months. And then when they operated on my hernia, they had to put a piece of mesh in the side of my stomach. And now, I don't know,
They figure I just might have a bowel blockage. Last Sunday I was passing blood. I thought it was this hernia deal that let go again, but so on Tuesday they're going to take a look and see what's cooking there.
Well, have you had to pay for this, or the government paying
for
it all along? Or?
No. That's one thing I'll say. This malnutrition deal. This malnutrition deal, if I should take the pneumonia tomorrow, I can go into the hospital. I can go into here like that. This malnutrition, it covers everything.
Is this what you have suffered from during your stay in prison?
Yeah, well, malnutrition is a rundown condition. Well, okay, if you weighed 187 pounds and you get down to 93, well, you had malnutrition. Right. And so they've got to prove that if you wasn't there, well, you wouldn't have got this. And there's no way in the world that they can say, well, if you hadn't been there, you wouldn't have got this. You wouldn't have got pneumonia. Mm-hmm. Or you would have got pneumonia, eh?
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's no way they could do it, so.
You've been wounded, you had diphtheria?
Yeah, dysentery.
Lagra.
Okay. So.
Plus, I suppose other such things. Fleas? Lice?
Oh, the lice, when I come out of the hospital, I wasn't lousy when I come out of Bone Road Hospital, eh? But everybody in the prison camp was lousy. So Bob Manchester and Tommy Marsh, they was two sergeants. They was sleeping in a little cubicle, and used to lay your undershirt and everything out on a. There was one hut that had got smashed down. There was just a cement block there, eh? And then was. Summertime, that thing would get so hot you couldn't stand on it. Well, you'd just lay your shirt there and it would cook all the lice. They'd just fall off. You'd pick your shirt up. But the next morning, it'd be just lousy. So when I went into Shamshapo Camp, Bob and Tommy, they said, you can sleep with us, Chester, but you're going to be lousy in the morning. I said, well, I might as well be lousy tomorrow morning as the mix, so let's go. Hey? Yeah, stick in the head.
You think the government's treated you pretty fairly? Was that
well, I'll tell you. You know, what gets me, it's a funny thing. When my kid brother, he was over in Europe, and as a the picture I was showing you, well,
right.
he was over in Europe, and there was... reconnaissance. And when the war was over in Europe, they made up Sea Force to come home and go to the Pacific. And you got extra pay for this. And us guys, when they passed this through Parliament, for to give these guys that volunteered to come home from Europe, to go to the Pacific. He landed in Winnipeg here on his way to the Pacific the day the war was over. Just in here in time for the celebration. And when they make this thing up, they don't put us on it. And it took us 2 years fighting to get put on Sea Force so we could get this extra pay, and we were sitting over there when they passed the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Eh?
Yeah. It doesn't seem quite right at all.
No, they passed a bill. Hey, this is what gets me. They passed, this is what got us guys, too. They passed, when we asked them about it, they said, well, you guys are not included. You're not in Sea Force. But still, we were sitting there when they passed the bill.
Mm-hmm.
We'd been sitting there for 2 years when they passed the bill in Ottawa to give the guys from Europe so much a day extra if they come home and went to Europe, they went to the Pacific. So it just shows that maybe it was an oversight, but I don't. In a way, you wonder how they could. Hey.
Yeah, it makes you wonder.
Hey. It makes you wonder in a way. But as far as my medical attention, and I think myself, we done better when Churchill, you know, from the North End here, was Veterans Affairs Minister. Personally, myself, I think the Veterans Affairs Minister that we had and this new guy that we got now, that, you know, in the last 3 weeks, we just got another one. No. No, but as far as I'm concerned, Churchill, he had been overseas. This your young guy that I don't know about this guy we haven't had on long enough. But imagine a young Frenchman from the province of Quebec. Well, what good is he going to do a veteran? Right? No way. To my notion now, maybe I'm wrong.
We'll just have to wait and see, I guess.
Eh? We'll just have to wait and see, but as far as I'm concerned, this is it.
There's only a couple more questions. Then maybe you would like to add something. I think we've covered most of it pretty carefully. There's one thing I'm curious about. It's, you people really went through hell because of the war and at the mercy of the Japanese. But I was wondering how you feel about the Japanese now.
Well, I don't know. It's been so long ago that, really, in a way, I don't think anybody holds any certain ones. Yes, we'll say like this Kamloops and this Sato, and just the same way as the guys over in Germany would. The guys was over in Europe would hold it against some of the Germans, I think. But the individual chap. I don't see why hold the
that answers it.
Eh?
I think that answers it quite well. And what about your feelings about war? Maybe that's a second. Maybe just war in general.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how you're ever gonna stop everybody in the from starting, you know, if every individual in the world said I ain't going to fight, well then you wouldn't have any wars. But no way are you going to do that. You always got some cluck that can agitate enough people to start something, and then when you do, well, what does the other guy got to do? Just the same way as I said when I hear the Germans bombing the kids in the schoolyard. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to sit home, or are you going to and wait till he gets finished bombing over there and then start bombing your schoolyards, or are you going to take him on his own ground? My way of thinking is you're going to take him on his own ground. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but. Maybe you're just adding fuel to the fire, but.
Well, that's what you did do.
Yeah. Eh?
That's what you did do.
We added fuel to the fire. Yeah,
well,
we.
No, that's what you did do.
We took him on his own ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I personally myself, I think this is better to take him on his own ground than to let him come on ours. So. Can you? I don't know whether you can say you're for it or you're against it. Everybody's against it, I would say, until some radical gets a certain amount started, and then it just.
Is there anything else you'd like to add on the experiences in Hong Kong, on the war, anything that happened there?
No. I don't think so.